Welcome to the Blue Economy Podcast, presented by Rhode Island, the Ocean State. I'm your host, David Hirschman, and today we're going into our archives for a pre-COVID interview that we taped with Rob Necht, the founder of shellfish marketing and distribution startup Real Oyster Cult. Welcome to the podcast, Rob.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, David. Really, really psyched to be here.
So can you tell me a little bit about where Real Oyster Cult came from? You know, how long did it take for you to come up with the lyrics for Don't Fear the Reaper? No, just kidding. I just wanted to get a little into the background. How did you get interested in oysters and kind of in the business of shipping oysters all around the country?
Yeah, so I have a family oyster farm that I run with my family and my wife and four kids, although the youngest is not quite farming yet. And I started that about 15 years ago, kind of right as the oyster renaissance was happening. And our bay in Duxbury, Mass, is where we have the farm, and it's become a large producer of oysters for Massachusetts and beyond. And I've always worked on the water, but I also was moonlighting for a tech company, and kind of a light bulb went off of how to solve some of the antiquated issues with the seafood industry, supply chain, and whatnot, and use tech to do that. And obviously, being a oyster farmer, I felt like I had some insight in that now, so I could kind of bridge those two together, and it just sort of happened that way.
What made you want to be an oyster farmer originally, or how did that come up?
So I grew up on the water and always spent time on the water, whether it was I ran racing yachts, built custom sailboats, ran a maritime school, ecology programs, worked for Outward Bound, did all these things on the water. So the sea is kind of in my soul, and also really like technology. So the merging those two things made sense.
Well, so, you know, obviously people have been growing and eating oysters for a long time. And in fact, I read somewhere around the turn of the 20th century, there were 1 million oysters consumed every day in New York City alone. And then more recently, the oyster industry in the Northeast has been growing at, I believe, like a 20% rate recently.
That's correct. Yeah, it's about 20 to 25%. And last year, 2019, we're upwards of like 38%.
Oh, wow.
So we've had a really nice spike in the industry. And it's really, really exciting to see for sure. And to your point, you know, Henry Hudson, Hudson River, Henry Hudson in 16, I believe it was 07 or 9, had to navigate over 200,000 acres of oyster reefs. And so taking that to where it is now, and obviously Manhattan Harbor, it has a lot to come to get back to that. But the oyster renaissance, I think, is here, and it's here to stay. So it's not really, I mean, it is trending, but I think it's here to stay. Because I think I read a stat in 1895, 35% of people's protein intake was from oysters. I mean, can you imagine that in the city of Manhattan?
Yeah.
So that's a stat I don't know that we can get back to entirely, but it would be pretty cool if we did. And I think we're on a trajectory to be close to that in maybe 15 or 20 years.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about what the oyster renaissance is, actually? You know, obviously it's like the last 15 years. Previously, I thought they were almost extinct in parts of Rhode Island, right?
Yeah, that's true. So for wild harvest, so what we're talking about is oyster farming, which is the real renaissance of bringing oysters, growing oysters from a hatchery seed source, putting them in the water in containment, and then growing them out to adult size for consumption. And that's about depending on where you are, it's about a 2 to 5 year process.
Right.
Yeah. So I have friends in Florida that can grow oysters in 140 to 150 days to a market size 3-inch oyster. Now that's the extreme. And then friends in PEI that have farms that it can be a 6-year process.
And it's because of temperature? Is that the...
Yeah, it's temperature. It's a shorter growing season. So you think about it's all about the sunlight. They have more sunlight and the colder water as well. They just grow slower, less food to eat.
And in terms of the kind of the renaissance as an economic thing, like why are people growing and eating a lot more oysters than they did 15 years ago?
I think it's really availability, like you just touched on, all these different farms coming online now. I read a stat a year and a half ago that 70 farms just in Massachusetts, new farms came online. In Rhode Island, I think the number's a little smaller, but not much. So it's a economic resource now. It employs multiple, you know, groups of different people that are, they're in that supply chain that are growing it and selling it. So it's really, you know, it's a nice, steady, growing industry. And I think we haven't even gotten into the flavor profile. So right. Get me started on that. And that's really exciting as well. But the industry as a whole is definitely growing.
Well, is it growing also, one of the things I think's interesting about the way you ship everything all around the country is that you're sort of creating demand in places like the Midwest where you wouldn't necessarily think to get oysters all the time. Is it because there's more demand in kind of farther flung places, or is it, are people just like eating more oysters?
I think they're eating more oysters because there's more availability and there is more flavor profiles. And just like wine in the 90s when it kind of started booming and Napa just exploded, and a lot of California, it wasn't just, you go to a restaurant in 91 and it was, do you want the red or do you want the white? Now you've got this huge wine menu. It's the same thing with oysters now. We offer that exactly, a service where customers, and a lot of our customers are landlocked ocean lovers. They grew up, maybe they summered on the Cape, or they grew up in, somewhere in Rhode Island, and now they're in Kansas City, and I miss oysters, and now they can get them fresh to their door, and they can try all these different flavors, West Coast, East Coast, Alaska, New Zealand. We have them all on our platform, and we roll them over every week or two to give people, you know, new different flavors, and we do it seasonality too. I mean, there are certain oysters in season that are better at other times. You know, when oysters are spawning, they're not as delectable, so we'll take those off the platform and wait until they're back in season in a, you know, different time of the year.
Actually, maybe sort of going back a little bit, maybe explain what Real Oyster Cult does and kind of how the company came about.
Right. So we, as oyster farmers, we started touring around, visiting other farms, and I was would visit other farms and conventions. Hey, how are you doing? How are you doing this? And just trying to educate myself as a farmer, and then trying their product and going, oh my God, that tastes amazing. Oh, I still haven't met an oyster I didn't like. So, taking that and saying, where can I get these? Oh, I can only get them in your small region, and the amount of different types of brands we have on.
And the challenge is largely the perishability of it, you know, getting it to far-flung places quickly and in good shape and all that.
Absolutely, yeah. So, the farmers will grow them, and then getting them from the farm to our facility in Boston, and then getting them out to the customer as quickly as possible. And then, yeah, it's all about the supply chain, the box size. We use a temperature sensor in each box, and that helps. It stays in that cold chain, and if it doesn't, then our customer knows to call us, and we'll work something out, reship, or have them cook the product.
Can you talk a little bit about how you like started it from a tech point of view, or like thought about it, you know, I guess in a technological way?
Yeah, I mean, the tech is a small piece of it. The supply chain is actually harder than the tech piece. The tech piece was more fun to solve, to be honest. We use a lot of third party sources to tech instead of rebuilding a whole website. There's right.
So it's just like e-commerce.
Yeah, you can use e-commerce engines. We did build our app with our team from a custom app because we just couldn't find anything out there we really wanted that told the story properly about our farms and being able to scroll through those and have that nice user experience. And that probably set us apart in the industry to start. And then just. Staying true to, so yeah, you know, tech is a big piece of it, but the supply chain piece and having a really high quality product delivered to our customers consistently is really the biggest piece, in my opinion.
Do you find that oyster farmers are generally resistant to technology? Like, I know that you sort of started off as having your own farm and seeing kind of places where you could plug in tech to do what you needed to do. Do you think that is it still largely an old school industry? Do you think?
Absolutely, I think it's changing. I think I have some friends that are built an oyster app to help you manage your farm, which is neat, which I use on my farm. Um, and there there it's just, one, it's a really challenging environment. So for technology, to have a laptop on an oyster farm is laughable. It would just get destroyed. So a lot of us were using, you know, spreadsheets on our phone or something like that, and then the real estate's small. So there are challenges with that. And I also think, yes, a lot of farmers that have been doing it the same way for the last 15, 20 years, or maybe they were fishermen, they had a lobster fishery, lobster boat, and they transitioned to oyster farming. They don't want to deal with tech. They're out there on the water for a reason. They want to be, you know, communing with nature, so to speak, and out there with their oysters. And so I think it is a hard place to sort of implement tech. But the younger generations is growing up with tech, so they also see, wow, instead of doing white notes, I can have everything in one place and actually, you know, have a data exhaust and analyze that, and how is my seed source doing and my crops doing compared to last year and the year before, or different seed sources, all those things. But I think farmers have a real hard time implementing that on you know, in the sea. It's just, we have a hard enough time keeping our engines running and things like that.
Is a lot of that kind of stuff scheduling, like, you know, when to turn the bags?
I would say it's threefold. So a lot, especially when people are starting out in oyster farming, but even when you've had a big oyster farm, you've got environmental challenges. So that could be your area, storms, ice, disease, things you can't control. That's one big challenge with farming. Another big challenge is your margin, right? So a lot of farmers, especially smaller farmers, don't know what their landed cost is. And what I mean by that is all your inputs that go into, wait for that. What I mean by landed cost is all of your inputs that go into growing that oyster, and how much did that cost you when you get to the landing and you sell that product?
Well, because, you know, I looked at this about a year ago, and it, you know, like, the seeds cost like just 6 cents, and then in theory you could sell them for a dollar, right? And so in theory the margin could be huge, but I know there's all this stuff in the cost of
absolutely between, yeah. Right, and every time you touch an oyster you're losing margin, right? You're losing, so and where's that balance between getting that delicious oyster that a restaurant will pay a top dollar for, and then also not touching it too much and having it be, you know, or overspending your labor on getting that product to market and having your margin just disappear doing that, and everything in between. I mean, my farm does on bottom, so we'll grow things out to a certain size, put it on the bottom to grow because we feel like it really helps the shell and the flavor, but we lose a lot. So I'm doing a great job on my farm if I have a year where I grow, where I get 40% return.
Oh wow!
Which in a lot of businesses people will go, you're crazy. Well, we overseed for that. If I want to land 1 million oysters 1 year, then I'll buy 2.5 million because I know that many I'm going to lose in the process along the way.
Specifically because you do them on the bottom.
Yeah, but you also can get diaphragm disease and other issues. I mean, the biggest change in the industry was disease-resistant seed, which happened about 25, 30 years ago, and now we all buy that seed. My second year farming, I ramped up and said, I'm going to do 1 million seeds. It's going to be great. Well, I sold $10,000 growing 1 million seed, and it cost me $35,000 to grow that seed for that year in just labor, forget all the other costs. And so that was a bad year, obviously, for my farm. But I learned, hey, I'm going to diversify my seed source. I'm going to buy more disease-resistant seed. So you learn these things along the way. But there's so much more information than when I started out there already, and that was only 15-plus years ago.
But it's still fairly large variables, like, you know, year to year could be big or small.
It can be. Yes, it can be. I think people that do different cultures, like on what's called surface culture, and they're in bags and containment, or even off bottom in cages, their mortality rate's only about 20%. So they're getting 70-80% of their product. So they have definitely a better, can game the system a little bit better. But their product, they go through other steps. Their profit margin can be a little less. They have to touch it more. They have to sink it in the winter because of ice. There's all kinds of other issues. Take it out of the water. If you have a Cape farm, a lot of people do that.
They take them out of the water.
They completely take all their product out of the water, put it in they call it pitting. In the olden days, they used to actually dig a pit and put it below the frost line.
And they'll live through the summer like that?
Oysters are super hardy. It's over the winter. Yep.
Yeah.
And now I have friends that do it, and they put all their product in a refrigerated truck, like an 18-wheeler, store it all in there for the winter, and they lose maybe 5% of it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I know that you do, and which you did at the See Ahead show that we had last fall, is you do kind of like a on-the-road showing people how to shuck.
Yep.
kind of service. Can you talk a little bit about why you started doing that, and kind of, you know, is shucking like a limiting factor that a lot of people have when they?
It is if you make it a limiting factor. So I always tell people, like, oh, shucking's so hard, I don't know if I can do it. And it's like, well, can you boil water and cook pasta? I mean, it's like Julia Child is out there showing you how to make a great dish. French cooking was really intimidating, and now it's not so intimidating when you watch someone do it. So that's really what it's all about for us.
I mean, I've almost cut my hand off a few times trying to open an oyster. Well, but not since you taught me how to do it, though.
Oh, good. See, so for folks that maybe are not as, you know, comfortable with a knife, which I have plenty of friends are, then, you know, get a steel glove. Or there's always a solution to any of those problems. But what we've really found with shucking is it's a very visceral experience. And when you learn how to do it, you almost own it to a point where you just want to keep doing it. And it's really fun. And especially with everyone all on their devices these days, it's great to just sit around with friends and family and open up oysters and have that experience. It's something that's, our customers tell us all the time. I taught my daughter how to shuck. It was amazing. We love it. You know, that to me is what kind of lights me up, is when I do share that skill with people. And I'm, to be honest, I'm not the best shucker. It's not, to me, it's not about speed and all that shucking competitions. It's just about getting the darn thing open and enjoying it with your friends and family and not hurting yourself. Although I've hurt myself plenty of times, but, you know, it heals.
So, you know, you've developed this system for, you know, logistics, I guess, for perishable items. One would think that it's not just oysters that you could transport that way or send all around the country. Do you have any plans to expand into anything else?
Yeah, we do. So we have a party box where we sell mussels, clams, and oysters. And we've talked about working with some folks in spirulina. We've talked about seaweed. And all those different products have different challenges, and they're not unsurmountable for sure. So we've definitely looked at taking our model and expanding it to other product offerings, which we do on our own site now. But I'm just have a affinity for oysters, so it's something that we're really hyper focused on. But also, yeah, we could throw in some other products, and you could use those same technologies to ship those as well, for sure.
Well, so the ocean's a big place.
A lot of coastline.
A lot of coastline. Rhode Island alone has 400 miles.
Yep.
As we've learned on this podcast. One of the things that we keep getting into in this show is different people who have to use the same ocean resources, be it space or, you know, other kind of ocean resources. Can you talk a little bit about how oyster farming and, I guess, the oyster industry in general is, you know, in relationship to other ocean industries that you kind of share space with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for oyster farming, our biggest challenge, depending where you want to farm, is what we call NIMBY, which is not in my backyard. So the coastline, especially in New England, where we're situated, has a lot of very high valued properties on the water, and does someone that's paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in property taxes want to look at an oyster farm with what goes along with that, especially if it's floating gear. So there's buoys, there's, you know, equipment, and I think that has some mixed use issues there. But as far as commercial aspects,
is it that people think it's unattractive, or is it it's just like the boat traffic in and out?
I think it's a combination. So I would say that yes, we've run into it in our community where a property owner did not like the look of the floating gear. In a lot of our area, we can't do floating gear, but we do have a lot of buoys that mark our submerged gear, and there's sailboat traffic. I'm a sailor. I love to go sailing and motorboating too. But I think the benefits outweigh those. Okay, sorry, you can't motorboat in that one little area or sailboat in that area. And I think, you know, there's a balance that we can do, and there's a lot of ocean out there. And I've read some papers and research on being able to push further offshore and still have a viable farm, and that can work, especially if you do a vertical farm. We can't do vertical farming in our area, but it's a really cool concept of being able to grow oysters and then seaweed and mussels and all in the water column, all, you know, vertically over one area.
Which are to, like, what's the advantage of a vertical farm? That they
so you're really
sort of feed each other?
Well, not necessarily that, but you're utilizing the whole water column. So if you have 30 feet of water, you might might, could grow oysters on the bottom in cages. You can hang ropes to grow mussels and seaweed and or clams, and then have all that in one compact area. So you're using the whole space of the water column and using the whole vertical, you know, concept. Where we grow, we're very tidal. So the, you know, tide goes out and minus tide, you can walk across our bay. So vertical farming really wouldn't work in that area. So it is area specific. But I think ocean farming is going to be a thing of the future. And especially you could maybe combine it with wind towers and in between the wind towers, because it's not great for drag fishing. Well, that could be great for a farm in between those towers. Absolutely. So
when you say ocean farming, you mean sort of deep, like outside of the state lines?
Or, right. Yeah. Offshore. Yep. Deeper
I was stuff. In a course last, I guess it was at Salem State for someone's growing mussels. Like way, you'd set up a whole mussel rig out there.
Yep.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of being sort of further offshore? I mean, aside from having a longer trip to...
I would say that that's one, is you're further away from it when you want to tend to your farm. Boat traffic, and especially big commercial traffic. So you'd have to pick a zone that is not in a commercial shipping area where it can be avoided. Even pleasure craft might not know it's there. So things like that. Ocean storms could be a real problem. Although if they're designed right and anchored properly, I've seen them survive pretty heavy, you know, hurricanes and storms pretty well, because it's all under the surface. So they kind of sway with it.
Something I've often wondered is that, you know, they're like, you know, you're farming, you're putting out like, you know, $1 million worth of seed and product and whatever, and you're just kind of putting it out there in like a fairly public area. Is there a lot of theft?
I wouldn't say there's a lot of theft. I've read some articles, and I know one farmer on the Cape that where a lot of the Cape farms, you can walk to their grants or their leases, and I think in that instance, people kind of can walk out there in the middle of the night and snatch a few oysters. I've heard of a large amount of oysters being taken, you know, in the seed stage, but for you to steal a market-sized oyster of any volume would take you a lot of effort and time.
You'd be trying to unload them also.
Right, you'd probably unload them, sell them on a market, and notice that. I know our local shellfish constable, we are not, even though it's our own farms, we're not permitted to land shellfish in before sunrise and after sunset. And that rule was really implemented so that you couldn't, you know, if there was anyone doing it at night, you know that person's, you know, stealing it. So I think that things, measures like that can help. So I wouldn't say it's a huge threat, especially if you have a massive scale farm. You're not worried about someone taking 5 or 6 home to eat. I mean, that's if they feel like they need to do that, then go for it, in my opinion. But yeah.
Are there any sort of like odd or interesting stories about, I'm sure there are a lot, that of oyster farmers you've talked to who've had odd things happen?
Odd things happen.
I don't know if that's the way to ask that question, but...
Yeah, I mean it's a strange industry.
I feel like there are a lot of characters.
Oh, absolutely.
The kinds of people who are drawn to becoming oyster farmers are, in my experience so far, an interesting bunch.
They are, and I would say some of the most interesting times have been either in a parking lot or the pub afterwards, where you might have some farmers that used to be lobster fishermen, and their mentality is, stay away from my catch. I'm going to, you know, the shotgun in the boat, you've heard all those stories. Yeah. Well, they bring that to oyster farming, and for our community, a lot of us are... If my boat breaks down, I can have the guy next to me, my buddy Greg's, hey, you want to borrow my boat? He'll be the first guy to let me use his equipment and help me out, which is really nice. And that's more of a kind of like a heartland farming community. We all look out for each other. But we have had some folks that come into the industry that are, you know, that just basically are very territorial and don't want to share anything and don't have that sort of, hey, we're all in this together mentality. And you know, breaking up some fist fights and having some arguments and that's all. I mean, it's a learning curve, and those guys have mellowed out. Now they realize, wow, my boat breaks, I can call Rob and he will help me out. So it's a nice community, and I think there's a lot of wacky guys in it. There's ex-lawyers, there's ex-bankers, and they get into it and have a ton of money and then get their ass kicked and realize, holy shit, this is a lot of work and this isn't easy money, and I got to be out here in the middle of January when there's ice going by. And so that you know, can temper your ambitions pretty quickly.
Do you get like a lot of sort of dabbler kind of people who, like, who instead of a vineyard they get an oyster farm? And
absolutely,
like, holy shit,
absolutely. So when I first had this idea, I was moonlighting for this tech company, and he had actually invested in Real Oyster Cult, and he designed iTunes for Apple, big guy out of Apple with Steve Jobs, and he's like, Rob, instead of buying a vineyard, can I invest in the oyster thing? I'm like, sure, Jeff, go ahead. Just same thing, totally. It was a piece for him to tell all his friends, oh, this is really cool, I'm involved in oyster farming. Little did he know that now he's really psyched because it's great for the environment and it's a cool piece to be involved with, you know, and it's different than a vineyard, right? So it's something special and unique.
Well, can you talk about the environmental part of it also? I mean, we touched on it a little bit earlier, but like, you know, obviously the, you know, oysters are bivalves and they clean the environment around them. Talk a little bit about kind of...
Yeah, oysters are basically a superfood for, you know, for the ocean. Just the mass of them being there, even if they're in containment on a farm, they create a natural reef, or not natural if it's a farm reef, for other species to live. They clean the water so that eelgrass and other grasses can come back if there's a lot, because there's a lot of, you know, runoff from people's lawns and nitrogen in the water. They take nitrogen out of the water. They remove CO2, they sequester heavy metals in their shell. They do a lot of great things for the environment that I know our current administration wants to plant a billion trees or trillion trees or whatever that is. Well, the issue with that is trees, once they die, they actually release all that carbon again. Where when oysters are remediating carbon in the water, they don't release it. They sequester it in their shell. So it doesn't get re-released into the atmosphere. So there's a couple scientists working on that saying, we need more oyster farms, we need more mussel farms, we need more aquaculture. It's our path forward.
Well, I know that there's the Billion Oyster Project in New York as one example of, you know, they're using oysters to clean New York Harbor, right?
Absolutely, and I think the one challenge they have is they're trying to get to a billion oysters to get that natural reef system back and get the waters working again, and then their theory, which has been proven scientifically, will bring back the fish and other species into the area and return that to a natural ecosystem. Their challenge is they have to put all their oysters in containment because when they first started, they had them in different areas on just spread them out on rocks, and people were actually harvesting
them.
Yeah, in the middle of the night kind of thing. Yeah. And they had to have security cameras. It was kind of a nightmare because, you know, it's a delicacy, and I wouldn't eat one out of the Harlem River, but hey, yeah. Some people, you never know, right? So yeah, it's a challenge, but I think they can do it if they get enough mass. We've donated to them and supported their cause for sure, and they also bring in the education piece with the inner city kids in Manhattan, which is great too, and kind of hands on projects with the environment.
Tell me a little bit about the permitting process and how that's evolved with all these different entities sharing the water.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's kind of a little chaotic at this point. There are federal guidelines for federal waterways, but when you're in a town or a municipality waterway, whether it's state federal water or state jurisdiction waters or town, they all have a say in it. Massachusetts, it's actually the most chaotic. So a friend of mine is starting an oyster farm in Maryland, and he's asking me for my help. And I said, well, okay, you got to get the town buy-in and get all this. And he said, well, no, Rob, all I need to do is this one form on the state and go to the state, and the state says I can have it there. I have an open meeting. If there are objections from the town, the state will hear it, but the state makes the final decision. The town has nothing to do. And I was like, well, that's really streamlined and easy. With us in Massachusetts, it's completely the opposite. So every town has its own set of jurisdictions. Some are very similar baseline, but others are more nuanced because of the town resources. And I think the town should have a say in it because, you know, the town has resources you're going to use, the town landing to launch your boat. You're going to have refrigerated trucks show up to get the product off the water and into the supply chain. So I think the town should have a say in it. You have property owners that have, you know, want to have rights and view rights and view easements and all those things. So I think it is important to get community buy-in from everybody instead of just throw it in there and then everyone hates what you did. But there would be a nice, the state of Mass is trying to streamline it. And there's a lot of reasons why. One is if I want to sell my grant or my lease, I don't own the acreage I have out in the bay, but I own the right to it. And I own the right to it for...
The right to that geographic spot.
To that geographic spot for an indefinite period of time. I just renew it every 10 years. There's no limit to cap on it. And then if I pass away, I can have my kids have it. So it's something that has value. And the state wants to maybe consolidate, or there's some people in the state that want to consolidate that, so that right now in our town, you have to live in the town. A corporation can't own a farm. They want a small hold approach to the farming there, which I think is good, because if a corporation came in and bought everyone else out, and then everyone, you know, then the corporation has less contact with the town, and there can be more issues that go on with that. So I think the small hold approach is good. It's good for the economy. Each farm hires a ton of different employees and college kids in the summer and all that great stuff to spur the economy in the town as well. But then there can also be mismanagement with so many smallhold farms that people are just doing it as, oh, it's fun, or I'm doing it as a side thing, and then they leave gear out there, or they don't adhere to certain rules. So there's, you know, there's issues with both sides, but I think there's a happy balance in the middle. And I'm not sure. I know Maine is like that as well, where you apply to the state, and then there's a regional sort of board, but it's kind of all over the place right now. It's not Wild West, but it's somewhere in the middle.
But with, you know, obviously you just said 38% growth last year. You know, obviously it's something that people see as a growing industry and want to get into.
There's more and more challenges, because as we talked about earlier, there's less and less. I mean, there's only so many coastline real estate, shore, right, and water and bays and approved bays to grow shellfish. And so the resources there are going to eventually get maxed out. And then how we do that is, you know, I'll let the policy wonks figure that one out. But it's yeah, it's something that'll be a challenge going forward for sure. I think it'll just push people further offshore, as we talked about. And that's still a great resource. And I'd be excited to try some, you know, middle of Cape Cod Bay oysters, see how they taste, you know, deep water stuff.
Do they taste different?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So we work with over 90 farms right now, and I've tried more than 90 types of oysters, but there are nuanced flavors. And if you are the sommelier of and have a great flavor palate, which I don't, too much burning of pizza maybe as a kid or something. I don't have that where I can taste every note, but I can taste you know, subtle differences in even three or four bays over. Oh, there's a little bit more salt there, or there's a little bit more you know, umami finish or seaweed taste, aftertaste, or some more mineral in that oyster. And it's really fun to taste those subtleties.
And aside from like just choosing location, how, like, are there ways to manipulate those tastes at all? Like in the way that you do?
Yeah, there are a little bit. I mean, the oysters are what they eat. So whatever is growing in algae or growing from the environment in that area, is they're going to pick up some of the flavor from that. Whether it's on sand, rock, silt, mud, they're going to pick up some flavor from that as well.
But people don't like introduce like chocolate into this environment or whatever. Like, you know,
no, thank goodness. Like, yeah. I mean, that could be coming, and I hope it doesn't. I mean, the water, you know, is very controlled, so I don't think that would be advantageous. But you can tumble your oysters more to get a deeper cup, to get a different mouthfeel, a meatier oyster, things like that. If you grow off bottom, they tend to have a little bit more, a higher salinity content or salt taste to them, because they're just pumping more and more water on bottom, which gives that maybe a little bit more mineral and earthy taste to them. So that those differences, yes, you can do by just growing the same species of oyster three or four different ways, which is fun to experiment with that.
Can you just talk a little bit about the health benefits of oysters and some of the, you know, obviously healthy eating is a big trend these days. Why, you know, does that sort of build into the, you know, economic boom that oysters are having right now?
I think it does. I think it for sure helps. I mean, they're not only delicious, but they are really healthy for you. They're super high in zinc and some fatty acids and proteins that are great for your body. And so that's a huge piece of it. And we highlight that. There was an interesting piece I read. Two Japanese scientists had done some research on the oyster producing a chemical that helps with wound healing, and it's the only species on the planet that produces this chemical naturally. And so I think that's, you know, maybe the sports world will get onto it. You know, Tom Brady will be shucking and crushing oysters. But it is something that I think is important because people want to know where their food's coming from. And that's what our platform does, and a lot of other farms do too, is they really tell their story. And hey, here, you can go onto our site and meet the people, obviously virtually, on who's growing this product, what water it's coming from, and that people want to know that. And I think it's a great selling point for sure.
And you have kind of relationships with a lot of the farmers that are on your platform as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And we've toured a lot of the farms and hung out with them and ate their product and other, you know, drank some beers and had a great time with a lot of, and they're really a diverse group of folks that farm for sure. From retired lawyers to, you know, a guy starting right out of high school that wants to get into it because he's really into working on the ocean.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Blue Economy Podcast presented by Rhode Island, the Ocean State. And thanks again to Rob Neck for taking the time. If you're listening for the first time, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. And if you want to learn more, catch up on past episodes, or shoot us a note with your comments, head to our website at www.blueeconomypodcast.com or look us up on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. From Providence, Rhode Island, the biggest little state in the union, I'm your host, David Hirschman. Thanks for listening.